It's Friday, March 31st, 2017. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. This week in Trumplandia, the drama and stakes ramp up in D.C. Michael Flynn to testify if given immunity. Nunes subplot thickens. Senate Intelligence Committee says they won't play games with investigation like the House is doing. And bye-bye to your limited privacy protections on the internet. Farewell to the clean energy plan. But on the other side of the ledger, Maryland bans fracking. Worry not, folks, because right here in PA, however, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf and the PADP approves two new injection wells. Think Oklahoma earthquakes. And also becomes a booster, that good old Democratic governor of ours, becomes a booster in favor of, you know, four more ethane cracker plants in the Keystone State. Pennsylvania up in the ante on anti-climate crazy. Wannabe governor of PA, Scott Wagner, says people just need to take a cold shower and we'll be fine. Wagner's campaign manager wants to make sure we know that Scotty is not a scientist. I repeat, not a scientist. Philadelphia DA race getting interesting. Civil rights attorney throws his hat in. Right-wing billionaire back think tank hacks in PA beg Sean to take their picture, please. Sean doesn't take their picture. Lancaster Stan, if you remember the folks that are getting ready to kind of blockade the pipeline construction out there in Lancaster of the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline, they're going to keep the trainees going on the weekend, but postpones their occupation as the pipeline is tied up in court. Ithaca College contingent faculty win big, and I mean big, folks. And I had a great weekend this past weekend, the Philadelphia Labor Notes Troublemaker Schools. I was there to talk about the ABSCUF strike. And it was seemed only fitting that while I'm talking to ABSCUF strike, the PASHE administration, Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education Administrators, start the retrenchment ball rolling. So tune in to the Rick Smith Show this and every Saturday night on Free Speech TV at 7 p.m. Eastern. Yours truly will be there once again, giving the weekly resistance report. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, and with the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And remember, folks, we need you to help keep Pull No Punches progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $2 a month. You can simply go to the RagingChickenPress.org and look for the support and membership tab. And you can become a member by just through our Podbean app. Just click on Become a Member, or you can become a patron through Patreon. Either way, that works for us. If you're not ready, not quite ready yet, at least, to become a member, no problem. You can still go to the same site, go to the support and membership tab on RagingChickenPress.org and click donate. And you can make a one-time donation right there. I know I keep on promising you a t-shirt release, and I'm sorry things just got a little nuts, especially this past week, which we'll talk about a little bit later on the program. But hopefully things will settle down, so I'll get those t-shirts kind of up and running on Teespring. Your purchase of a t-shirt helps, fund our writers. And that's kind of really what we're kind of all looking to do because we need to dig in for 2017. You know, we have been, we're not long in, we're only at the end of month three and already the insanity has been nonstop. And we need to kind of find every way possible to support our writers and get that investigative work keep on going. So, Sean, I think yesterday or the last 2 days was probably worth about 2 weeks of a news cycle. I don't know about you.
Yeah. I go away for work for like 6 hours and I come back in three bombshell stories about the same Trump, like different parts of this Trump Russia story break. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ. I feel like if you're away from Facebook or your computer or Twitter or whatever for like two or three hours, you might miss a huge story.
No, that's right. I mean, like what's that?
We're on edge 24/7 for like the next big bombshell story to hit.
No, that's right. I mean, this conversation we had when we first got on today. I mean, I got home yesterday. Yesterday was an insane day at work. I rush home. I get home. I've got a bunch of stuff to do, take care of my kids and this kind of thing, you know, get dinner ready, all that kind of thing. And then, you know, I crash early. I was exhausted. Wake up this morning, got to get up, rush my kids out for their yearly well checks at the doctors and then bring them to school, come home. My dad's coming to town with stepmom. And so I got to call them. Then I get come here of the podcast and I see this note from you that you sent me last night. You said, "What happened while I was at work?" And I'm like, what was that about? And you're like, really? Really? Right? So I had a chunk of period of time, which I wasn't paying attention. And all this stuff happened. All this crap came down, man.
Yeah. I didn't have the time to like fully like indulge myself in what the news broke. But the gist of it was like, so the David Nunes thing, right? We all know that he took a midnight trip to the White House the night, the day before he released his press stuff, right?
Just out for a walk, Sean. Just out for a walk.
Yeah, he was just out for a walk. He just had these two different cars and stuff like this. So they found out who gave him the papers, right? There's only like a handful of people with security clearances that can bring someone to the White House. So it wasn't that hard for the New York Times and then the Washington Post dueling it out again, releasing the names of two and possibly a third staffer who brought Nunes on. So they slip him this information the day before he goes to the media. The next morning, he goes to the media saying he has this information in his hand. He then goes to the White House and then he holds another press conference explaining what happened. And man, it makes you like, really, this is like really bad political theater. I mean, this is just like murkying the waters.
Well, look at this. Okay. So here's, this is just an update that was posted, a recent update that was posted to the Washington Post story. Now, listen to how convoluted it is. Just to go to your point right there, right? So this is the update. Nunes has now done some explaining, emphasis on quote-unquote some. He spoke again Thursday to Bloomsburg's Lake, who has concluded that Nunes, quote, misled him about the chairman's sources not being White House staff. Nunes conceded, quote, "I did use the White House to help to confirm what I already knew from other sources." Right? It's just like... it's insane. And I think everybody really needs to be cautious right now. And like, again, all kudos in the world right now to the Washington Post and New York Times for digging into this stuff and following this, because as we are not, you and I were talking before we went on air, it's unclear what the game is here exactly. You know, is this just about to cause mass confusion? Is this a play to basically try to get the media to bite and ultimately then to discredit the media for reporting false information? Or is it just to confuse everybody so we stop paying attention? I mean, I'm not so sure.
Right. Same here. I mean, I think it's mainly just like murky the waters and put some like sort of disinformation out there to then just like cause confusion. I don't think it's like to discredit the media, but like to cause enough like people questioning themselves. Well, like this is what happened, but these were intercepts they got, like that they were leaked. So how did they get those intercepts? And Barton Gellman last night suspected like there's a possibility that the White House is spying on the FBI to get the information that they're leaking out to the media.
Right. And then, you know, and
which
then
is like, and that's just like speculation from Barton Gellman. But we're talking about one of the best writers, one of the best intelligence writers out there these days is Barton right. Gellman. And he's like putting his theory out there. And I think he's someone you should probably like consider, at least consider listening to.
No, exactly. And then, you know, you say that, and that makes me think of, you know, when during the campaign, when there was all that weird stuff happening with the FBI, when we found out that, you know, Rudy Giuliani has been, you know, tied in with that New York office of the FBI, and those folks in the FBI were basically, you know, Breitbart heads that were trying to drive stories against Clinton. There, you wonder if there's not factions within the FBI that are playing one side against the other here. I mean, again, this is pure speculation, but the kind of stuff where I said, you know, speculation at this point, as I was saying before we went on air too, is like, you know, there were things that we thought that would be just kind of crazy scenarios 3 months ago are now proving to be kind of like mild compared to what reality has given us.
Right. And then like, and then the second story that broke last night was that Michael Flynn, Wall Street Journal reported, got the scoop on this, is that disgraced General Michael Flynn is going to testify in front of the Senate Intel Committee if he gets immunity, some sort of like full immunity. And like, that's just like, okay, so that has me questioning, like, what's his deal here? Because like, everyone's like rejoicing, oh, the shoe's finally going to drop on Trump. And I think this might be like another disinformation campaign by Trump, or making him fall on the sword to deflect the blame from somewhere else.
I agree with you. Look, I mean, Flynn has shown that he has no problem lying or kind of covering up information or being misleading. So I don't know why on earth. Look, I mean, I think part of this is being driven by the fact that Democrats especially, right, and people that kind of lean towards the Democratic Party don't like what's happening with Trump, at least. They're looking for that silver bullet, right? They're looking for this, and they're looking to elevate anybody, right? I mean, they're willing to forget what Michael Flynn did, right, if he'll be the hero against Trump, right? Which I think that's a really dangerous scenario when you've got we got someone like, you know, Flynn, who is not a good actor, right? I mean, we have every reason to suspect that what we're about to see is like a new plot twist, rather than kind of getting the bottom of getting some answers. Who the hell knows?
Yeah. So those were the two things I missed while I was at work last night.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, and, you know, and again, and then we have to then what's going to follow up now. And now it looks like you're going to have two kind of battling, so to speak, investigations for the Senate Intelligence Committee is basically saying that they're going to go do the investigation and they're not going to play games like they've done in the House. So they're kind of willing to bring on and kind of keep the hearings going, or start the hearings and get those things going. While the House seems to be, you know, under Nunes's direction, is actually locking down and kind of preventing any further hearings.
And I don't know what to make of this like whole issue. Like, it's hard to put, like, do I go full throat in thinking that take this like Cold War scenario that like some people on the left think that this is going down, or is this, I mean, to me, this feels like a legitimate scandal. I just don't know how big of a scandal this is.
Well, I would put it like this. I think it is a big scandal, period. Right. What the contours of that scandal are, right? That's where I get a little bit cautious. And it's been interesting following, you know, some of the discussions with Sam Cedar in the Majority Report, right? And this is actually something I said on the air last week, and he's been talking about it all week. One of the things that, you know, I look at what's happening with Trump, and I look at what's happening with Putin and all this kind of stuff, and I see it through the lens of the mob. Right. If you look at this through kind of, you know, like a mafia lens, this stuff makes sense in a different kind of way. It's not like spy versus spy as much as it is about, you know,
these people are straight up gangsters.
It's about the family, man. It's about the family. Right. And so, you know, and Maddow has done some interesting stuff on this. And again, I think you have to kind of read almost against the grain of some of the reporting, because a lot of the reporting, including the stuff from Maddow, wants to kind of push it into this, you know, government conspiracy stuff. But I think Sam Cedar's been really good on this by talking about, you know, Trump dealing with criminals, right? So maybe what we're really talking about is an international criminal conspiracy. Where it gets naughty, right? Where I think that people want to pick up the spy versus spy stuff is that, you know, Russia is basically, you know, a crime syndicate. Right. The government of Russia is a crime syndicate. And so there's overlaps between, you know, the kind of Russian mob influence and this kind of stuff, those oligarchs in Russia and politics. Those things have been meshed together. But, you know, I don't know. It's anything good at the end of that investigation. Right. I think it's bad. The question is, like, in what ways is it bad? Right. And that's good. And, you know, and again, now we said, to get more reports that Russia is looking to basically do some of the same stuff they tested out here. They're looking, got their eye in the French election to try out some of the same kind of stuff. So, you know, there's clear evidence, I think, or at least circumstantial evidence, right, that points in the direction of how Russia kind of went after our election, how they went after, they're going after French election. But more interesting to me, it has to do with some of the investigations that are going and looking at the money laundering, like following the money to these banks in Cyprus, how Trump money has always been tied into or right at the edge of these money laundering operations. That kind of stuff is where this is going to end up. And it doesn't make things any better. Right. It just makes it it just has to have us looking in different ways at stuff.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting watching this, especially one of the things I know, like thinking of like messaging wise, Going back to Lakoff and how he talks about authoritarianism, right? And how that's more of like a natural preset. It's not ideology like conservative or liberal. It's almost like authoritarian or progressive. Like you have those two type of narratives. And it's like the reason like no one like I'm sure like politically people don't agree with Putin, but there's a lot of people out there who like Putin because they fall in that authoritarian mindset.
Right.
And that's what Putin is, straight up just authoritarian leader.
And that's absolutely right.
And that's like one of the things that's like it's scary about this, how many people are supporting and giving cover to Putin when he's just a straight up authoritarian. And you look at like who Marie Le Pen is in the French election, she's also someone who's authoritarian, you know, someone who is going to be fascist, you know, like that right wing, that right leaning authoritarian type of leader.
No, that's a good point. And I think, you know, as you were talking about that, I think I just clarified in my head a little bit what I see as part of the problem. It seems like even those folks that are doing, you know, some good reporting and keeping up this investigation and not trying to go, you know, whole hog into the, redoing the Cold War scenario kind of stuff, or, you know, make Russia the enemy so everything's nice and neat, is that we're, for the most part, I continue to come back to hearing people want to read this through our kind of, I don't know, traditional or standard or normal political lenses. And what it makes it harder to do, right? And I think it's a harder thing for media to do without sounding like you've kind of gone off the deep end, is talking about what are the things that lead to the rise of something like fascism, like authoritarian within the United States. I still think that it's a hard sell, basically, to get the media to see that what we're seeing here is that we're seeing the potential for the rise of the of a corporate fascist state, or, you know, in ways. And again, even that coming out of my mouth makes it sound like I'm kind of going to the extremes. But, you know, I was thinking about this article. And again, this is something I heard the guy interviewed, David Roberts, on the Majority Report this week. I spent a lot of time in the car this week, more than I would have liked. So listen to lots of podcasts. And this guy, David Roberts, doing this stuff, he's calling tribal epistemology, right? And talking about the ways in which, you know, once we get our minds around or commit to a particular position, right, and that we're just going to defend that position, that everything that the other side says automatically sounds like it's an excuse that's being made for to hide their true intentions, right? But I also think that there's this part of that discussion is that there's also things that we want to believe about the operation of our society and our government that are kind of baseline, that are almost kind of subconscious, right? What's the thing that you can't go below? What's the norm? What is the kind of, you know, thing that everybody agrees upon? And I think that's what's been tested. That whole idea about things that we thought were like actual real rules and laws are turning out to be nothing more than norms or ideas or policies or the way things have been. And so finding how easy it has been for the Trump organization to begin to erode that baseline of what we assume is our floor when it comes to politics and democracy and that kind of stuff, that's what concerns me. And then how do you begin to make a case that what's happening here, what the road that this can go on, is not just authoritarian as like a nice rhetorical word that you use in political combat between Democrats and Republicans, but something that actually that we're going to have to seriously face. And especially you put that next to, and this is what I've been thinking about this week a lot. I've been reading this book called The Sixth Extinction, which is, you know, basically walking through the science of the, you know, history of extinctions on the planet and looking where we are now and how many scientists are already convinced that we're in the midst of this, in the midst of the kind of the next great extinction wave, right? In part because of what we've done to the planet, not just climate change, but that's a huge part of it, but other stuff too as well. But anyways, just thinking about the rolling back of the climate protections that we've seen under Trump, where does that lead? Well, that leads every scientist out there, or almost every scientist out there, is, you know, saying this leads to potentially catastrophic climate change. And what we've seen is this is Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, is like there is no bigger shock doctrine, right, than catastrophic climate change. right? And then what happens at that point? Well, you have the strong men. You have the the kind of right wing free market privateers corporate control stuff right down the road. I don't know. I mean, again, I know I'm, you know, these are just all conjectures and thought processes at this point. But those are the kind of arguments that I really need. We need to have discussions.
No, correct. And then I think last week on Real Time with Bill Maher, there was a historian on there. I don't know if you saw this. It was making the clips, but he was basically saying like, today's generation, that generation of World War II is now dying off. And, you know, we have a generation of millennials here who grew up at the end of history, you know, with the fall of like the there was no counterbalance in the world to look as an example of fascism or communism or something like that, because we passed the end of history. We don't have to worry about what's going on now. And it's kind of like he was saying like that, like, you know, having no historical presence of any of these like opposing forces in the world has now given a rise to this type of right wing attacks on the institutions. And he's like, if you want to fight fascism and fight what's going on, authoritarianism, you have to become part of the institutions. You have to protect the institutions themselves that are here to serve you, like government. You have to participate in those institutions and you have to be willing to fight for them, not just because if you let them erode away, then it's then it's like anything goes.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that, this is the why I thought that David Roberts' piece in Vox was real good and his interview in the Majority Report was so good, because it actually kind of got back to looking at that question of like, you know, the need to defend institutions. And I think it was Sam Cedar made the comment that, the left is being put in the position where, and not even just the left, but even like journalists, for example, are being in the position where they have to start to defend the institution. And how do you navigate a situation in which, journalism for the longest time has been wedded to this idea about like neutrality, right? But what David Roberts was arguing is that basically, it's one thing if you're saying you don't want to be take a side, right, between Democrats and Republicans or this political position or that political position. But Roberts was arguing, but journalists do need to take a stand and do need to have a position when the institution of the media or institutions themselves are under attack. Right. That's a different kind of situation. And I think it's a bit uncomfortable for people in, say, academia, for people in, law, for people in medicine, for people in journalism to get out of that professionalism hole. Right. To have to actually defend the baseline institutions in which we're part of. So, I think that's really what we face. And that's a longer term struggle. That's not the, out in the street stuff necessarily, although we do have the science march coming up. So your scientists are actually taking to the streets, which is a good thing. But I think that's the decisions we have to make. I mean, are we going to defend these institutions? Not just to go back to where we were under Obama, but just do it just to make sure that we have a baseline that post-Trump that we have a society that's salvageable.
Yeah.
So that's my happy talk for today. So we weren't planning on talking about that at all in this first part. So sorry about that, folks. But we have when we come back, we're gonna go for a break, and when we come back, we're gonna get into a little some of the climate stuff. We're gonna talk a little about what's happening in PA, what's happening in Maryland, and then Sean is gonna let us know about what the our Republican wannabe governor in chief Scott Wagner had to say about the good old climate that's gonna take us all tumbling down the hole of disaster. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. The nation was in the grips of the Great Depression. Long bread lines formed each day in major cities across the nation, with at least 1 in 4 people out of work. The crisis deepened as the Dust Bowl ravaged U.S. farmland, crippling farmers and limiting food production. In response, the newly elected president, Franklin Roosevelt, launched his New Deal programs, signing into law one of the most popular parts of the New Deal, the Civilian Conservation Corps. The CCC was a massive public works program. Unemployed young men ages 18 to 26 were eligible to enroll and to be put to work. They earned $30 a month working on public works projects. Participants lived in camps near the projects and had to send $25 home each month to their families. The size and scope of the initiative was truly staggering. At its peak, 500,000 men were put to work from 2,600 camps across the country. In all, 3 million men participated during the 9-year program. The camps were segregated, and 250,000 African-American workers formed 150 all-black crews. During the program, CCC crews planted nearly 3 billion trees, constructed 470 fire towers, built 97,000 miles of fire roads, and constructed facilities at 800 parks. If you see a stone bridge or a picnic shelter at your favorite park, look very closely. You very well might find a plaque describing how the project was completed by the Civilian Conservation Corps. The program indelibly improved the infrastructure of the nation, and it gave participants the dignity of work and the hope for a better tomorrow. Today, as the media reports lingering unemployment and crumbling U.S. infrastructure, just imagine what a program like the CCC could accomplish today, if only we had visionary leaders willing to enact.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. So when we left off, we were talking about, you know, catastrophic climate change and other sunny topics. But this week, it turned out to be quite a week when it comes to climate stuff. I'll start with the good things, right? And then we'll move to the bad things. I'll warn you ahead of time, the good part is real short. we get to the bad stuff. But in Maryland, that was kind of one of the really, really cool aspects. In Maryland, they banned fracking. Right. So they drew that line in the sand and said, Maryland joins a bunch of other states in banning fracking, including my home state of New York. So that was a good thing. Was that expected, Sean?
I didn't think so. I know the governor had health issues, right? A couple years ago, he came down with cancer.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, if the health issues behind fracking played a role in his decision to support it. I mean, I didn't really think that. It's odd seeing this coming from a Republican governor versus a Democratic governor.
Yeah, it seemed to actually come, you know, it take some people by surprise.
And this came out of nowhere, too.
Yeah. So that was kind of interesting about that. But, you know, so Maryland joins that. And that comes in the wake of basically, once again, Trump Organization with a full-on assault on President Obama's clean energy plan. If you remember, that was was supposed to be one of the hallmarks, climate hallmarks of the Obama administration. Now, if you have people in the anti-fracking world, right, Karen Ferdin, if you go to RagingChickenPress.org, and she's got a great piece up there this week called Ding Dong, the Clean Power Plan is Dead. And what's really, I think, smart about that piece, I'd encourage people to read it, is that it doesn't, you know, go down the easy road to say, like, oh, you know, pour the best thing from Obama and it's all gone. You know, Burke's Gas Truth, which Karen Ferdin is actually who's the head of, they were very critical of the clean energy plan from the get-go, not because it did good things for the climate, but because it didn't go far enough, right? It didn't take hard enough line given the time that we have to kind of turn the ship. But now even those modest gains that were made under the Obama administration, those are kind of in jeopardy at this point. At least they're going to be defunded to the point where they're going to be ineffectual. So that's not a good place to be when it comes to that clean energy plan. I mean, you've been following any of that this week, Sean?
Not too much. Just been working. I do know, like, what Trump has did with the executive order and allowing the coal plants to come back, but that's about it.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, it's just taking the gloves off, and you're basically going to allow for, you know, the burning of coal, and you're going to allow for new coal plants to go up, and you know, regulations. It's just a bad thing. It's just a bad thing.
One of the guys in the newsroom, it has been a writer, has been a journalist with the Scranton Times for like 30 up since like the late 1970s. His name's R.B. Swift. Mm-hmm. And we were talking because he's talking about how he likes to go hiking and everything. And we're in the newsroom talking about the Wagner, what we're going to be talking about next, but also the attacks, the EPA and stuff like this, and the Trump with the clean energy plan. You know, he was saying, you know, I remember living in a time where smog ravaged cities. Like, I remember when Pittsburgh used to get covered in smog. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when like rivers lit on fire. Like, this is the type of stuff we're going back to. And we're doing it willingly too. He's just like, we're like, those are the days we're going back to.
No, exactly. Well, here's it. For example, there's this piece in the it was on the Intercept by Sharon Lerner called "House Republicans Launch a New Assault on the EPA." So, as you actually, you know, you get Trump rolling back these regulations, the Republicans held kind of hearings, and I want to read a section of this, right? So the House Committee on Science, Sharon Lerner, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology began the day with a hearing called "Climate Science: Assumptions, Policy Implications, and the Scientific Method." It was held just 2 days after Trump's executive order killed federal efforts to address climate change. The hearing included testimony from three experts far out of the scientific mainstream, whose careers have been boosted by promoting theories that benefit Republicans and the fossil fuel industry. Expert witnesses Judith Curry, John Christie, and Roger Pielka Jr., who are frequently called on to present the Republican case for inaction on climate in Congress, all underscored the point that whatever is happening with the climate has been exaggerated and doesn't warrant serious action. A message that may be particularly welcome to administration officials who have already decided to take just that path. Christie, a climatologist at the University of Alabama, who insists that extreme weather events are not related to climate change, asserts that while the Earth may be warming, it's not due to human activity. Quote, "Mother Nature can cause such temperature changes on her own," he said. Right? Meanwhile, Pielka, a science policy writer at the University of Colorado, said he believes in climate change and suggested that carbon tax might be a good idea, but stuck by his idea that there's no evidence to suggest that hurricanes, floods, or tornadoes or droughts are increasing. Judith Curry, a former professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology, insisted that humans might be responsible for less than 50% of climate change, a possibility that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has given less than 1 in 10,000 chance of being true. Right. So why that's important is because this is the, you know, here's the lead, right? This is the House gets to call its witnesses, gets to set the tone for the discussions, and the people they have right out of the gate are the three angles of the assault on any kind of climate action that has a potential of rolling back these, you know, the most devastating effects of climate change. It's a bad scenario.
Yeah, it's. Oh God, we're in some bad times.
Yeah, we are. Well, you know, and I think that, you know, and here's the crazy here is right here in Pennsylvania, right? Is that now, remind everybody, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf, right? He just approved two new injection wells in the state of Pennsylvania. If you call it injection wells, where they take frack water waste, inject it deep into the earth, right? Now, what does that mean? Why does that matter? Well, go to Oklahoma, and Oklahoma has daily earthquakes now because of this practice.
And did you see the follow up to this? The DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, is actually suing townships that have banned wastewater injection wells within their community.
Exactly. So, you know, this again, once again, nobody will save us but ourselves, people, right? That's the message here. You put your hope in kind of like somebody because they got a D next to their name. You cannot do that, right? Because we have a governor in this state, right, who's clearly not going to do that. Now, again, I'm not going to say Tom Wolf is all bad, right? I have more options than on, off, either or, like in my toolbox. But when it comes to climate change, right, this guy has not been helpful. And he's actually in favor of bringing four more ethane cracker plants to the Keystone State. So, you know, here in Pennsylvania, where you've got, you know, has been, you know, other than North Dakota, you know, has been one of the central places for fracking, right, and shale development. And we've got north of us and south of us have both instituted fracking bans, but we have got a Democratic governor here moving whole hog forward. And, you know, again, Sean, I don't think it's going to get any better if Tom Wolf is voted out of the office and then we get, you know, Governor Scotty Wagner moving to take his place, especially after his comments this week.
Yeah, so that was actually pretty funny, though. And there's a background to that story with Wagner. You know, we're sitting in the I'm sitting in the newsroom talking to people, and Katie Meyer walks in, and Katie, I hear her start talking about, yeah, you can't believe this interview I had with Wagner. And we're talking to Roxbury. And I'm like listening to what she said. And she's like, yeah, he's like, she says something like, I haven't been to a science class in a while. Well, here's the direct quote. This is what he says. Like, I haven't been to a science class. I haven't been in a science class in a long time. But the Earth moves closer to the sun every year, you know. The rotation of the Earth, Wagner said. We're moving closer to the sun. And he said, then he said, we have more people, you know, humans, and have warm bodies. So heat is coming off. Things are changing, but I think we are, as a society, doing the best we can.
My God. So let's see. On the one hand, the Earth is slowly spiraling into the sun, according to Wagner.
Every day. Every day.
A little bit closer.
Actually, two times a year.
Gets real close. Gets real close.
We get real close, and then we go far away. And then we get real close again.
But it's not as far as it was before, Sean. We're that much closer. And then we get close again. Right? A matter of fact, I get so scared every single year when we get – I think we're going to go right into the sun, but we don't.
But sometimes we just pull ourselves away, and, man, it's like
– Thank God we got saved again, right, by God's hand. God's hand, he prevented it. He put it in front of the sun, so we bounced around. And now we got to do it all again. So we got to be good for one more year, right? So God will stop us again. I mean, this is freaking crazy.
I want to know, like, what Scott Wagner thinks if you walk to the edge of the horizon. Do you just, like, fall into space?
Exactly.
This isn't like climate denialism stuff. This is like grade A flat Earth shit that he's like talking about here. Like, this is,
well, I heard that he got some of that perspective because once he went on a deep sea fishing voyage, right, and he got so far out to the edge that he saw sea monsters.
Really?
Yeah, sea serpents, Sean. Sea serpents came out of the water, right?
Well, I mean,
here, the Earth is getting closer to the sun.
Well, you know, like Fred Flintstone actually had a pet dinosaur named Dino.
Exactly. That's where I get my science from, man.
there's a quote by Lewis Black. There are people who watch the Flintstones as if it were a made-for-TV documentary. This is that right there.
Exactly. But this is what's nuts from my perspective, right? You start a sentence with, I haven't been to a science class in a long time, right?
I'm not racist, but.
Yeah, exactly. And what follows from that part is, but I'm going to tell you all about what I think science is, right? I mean, it's like, I haven't been to a science class in a long time. How about, so I'm going to defer to the scientists on this one. Right? No. Instead, I'm going to say, you know what, Sean? People just got to stop running around so much because they're heating up their bodies and they're causing the whole planet to warm.
I don't know, but we're moving closer to the sun each year.
Jesus. Well, that's why people's bodies are getting so warm.
Gravity.
My God. It's like, I mean,
and Scott Wagner discovers gravity.
And let's be clear, folks, right? And, you know, and I've said this before. This is the guy who's the right-wing guy, but he's the smart one. I'm not so sure about this anymore.
It's like that game, who says Shaquille O'Neal or Scott Wagner? It seems like the flat earther bullshit from the basketball, the NBA, is trickling into the...
I know this is really amazing. I mean, this is incredible. And then you said, you were telling me too as well, that his campaign manager comes up to clarify this afterwards.
Yeah. So one more quick question. Were these, I wonder if his science teachers were PSEA members or not.
Well, you know, clearly.
Do you think they were unionized science teachers or?
Yeah, they probably were. And you know what he did? He said, they're union science teachers, so I'm not listening to them because they're lying to me.
They're stealing my tax dollars.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so putting jokes aside, a couple of statements were made from his office and then from his campaign staff. I'll go to the one from the campaign staff because I actually ran into his campaign staffer probably a little bit after he made this statement, like wrote this statement up for the media. And that's a good story I got to tell you in a few minutes. But this is what Jason High said. Now, this is like his handler that used to walk him around the Capitol everywhere. But now you see his handler is now his campaign director. So the handler can't be in the Capitol because that's against the law. You know, in Pennsylvania, you can't be working on the state dime and campaigning at the same time. So Jason's office is now as close to the Capitol as you can get, right across the street, mm-hmm. without being in the Capitol. But Scotty's little handler is not in the, it's not in the building anymore.
It's tough when you got to give your pet up.
Yeah. So what Jason said, his comments were meant to illustrate that there are a lot of theories about what causes global warming. Scott is running for governor, not to be a scientist. So he will leave it up to the scientists to figure out what the cause of global warming is. He is focused on making Pennsylvania a responsible steward of the environment while not overregulating to the point of stifling development and choking business out of existence.
This guy is freaking.
So he's still.
Talk about handling, right? I mean, this is the guy, again, look, you have these Republicans, these climate denier Republicans are out there and kind of want to say exactly what this guy just said. Basically, there's lots of theories about this over here, but to sit there and as a candidate yourself, propose your own preposterous ideas about this to just make everything absurd. I mean, it's crazy.
So I think the next time I see them on the street, I'm just going to pull my camera out next time and ask them what their theories of global warming is. And just because it's going to get to the point where someone's in a press conference, Scott or Senator Wagner, can you please tell me what you think about global warming? Can you clarify these comments?
Yeah. How closer do we get to the sun each day? Right. How much time do we have left here? It's nuts. But, this is it, right? I mean, again, let's just assume, let's give benefit of the doubt here for a second and say that he's just not a complete idiot, right? Again, the game here is to muddy the waters, just so you were talking about before, is to muddy the waters and get people to throw their hands up and say there's nothing that we can believe because we don't know what the truth is, right? Meanwhile, we've got I don't know how much more scientific evidence you need to be able to show that that we're headed towards really, really bad places if we don't kind of address this. And Wagner just basically wants it, stick the wedge in that door and keep the carbon emissions going. So
yeah, and I don't know if he's that stupid or he's pandering to someone at this point.
That's what I mean. And I think why I look at it this is
Alex Jones level pandering.
Exactly. Exactly. This is but either way, if he's pandering or if he's just an absolute freaking idiot, it doesn't matter, right? Because this is what is at the front. The end game is the same, right? I mean, either way, either that somebody planted this craziness into your head and you actually believe it, right? Or you're just kind of saying what other people want to, want you to say because they want to destroy it. Either way, the policy implications are the same.
So this goes, this leads into my story now, right?
Oh, please do tell.
So the other day I ran into Matt Briette, who used to run the Commonwealth Foundation, which is a think tank that's one phone call away from the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
Right. That's the type of reach he has. And he's walking down the street.
He runs some other freaking institute now, right?
Yes. Commonwealth part, some sort of Chamber of Commonwealth Entrepreneurs. It's almost like a Chamber of Commerce. So I don't know what exactly it's doing yet. So Briette's walking down the street with Scott Wagner's campaign director, Jason High. And they're walking into the manufacturer's building, which is right across the street from the Capitol. And the manufacturer's building is where Americans for Prosperity, Commonwealth Foundation, all these right-wing groups are housed in this one building, right?
Yep.
And so Briette goes, "Are you going to take a picture of us? Because I had my camera out." I was like, "No." And I took a few steps forward, and I'm at 10 or 15 feet away from these guys at this point. I turned around, put my arms out by my side, I got my arms out up in the air. Yeah. I was and I yelled, "But what I do want is that textbook where Wagner got his climate science from."
How did they take that, Sean?
They stopped talking and they just stopped and stared at me after I said that to them.
Yeah. I love those people, man. I'll tell you, because they sit there and they think they're being so sharp. "Are you going to take my picture in front of the manufacturing thing?" Right. And of course, that comes from the fact that you happened to be there one day, right? When you were taking people's pictures that were kind of coming out of this. And so they think that they're being all snide and they're being so clever. And then you just shut them up with a simple thing "Okay, well, how about your candidate? Tell us about where you got those things. You're going to show us the textbook." Crazy,
yeah,
crazy.
They kind of just stopped and stared at me until I turned around and started walking again.
Yeah.
But
so let's, so, you know, I just, I can't, look, maybe this is my own limitation this week, right? But I can't stay too long in the craziness of that kind of political stuff right now because my head is freaking going to explode. But so you've actually got some interesting stuff that's going on in Philadelphia, right? Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So about like 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, Seth Williams announced that he would not run for reelection for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, right? And this is when it was reported that he was going to be investigated by the FBI. That investigation has now turned into like 20 indictments against him for bribery, pay to play, and those type of issues, corrupt boilerplate corruption in Philadelphia Democratic politics.
Right.
So one of the people, so it has a wide open field of attorneys, former city officials running for district attorney. And one of the people running for district attorney is now going to be this guy called Larry Krasner.
No.
He's been a civil rights attorney in Philadelphia for the past like 25, 30 years. Hmm. A really big name within the civil rights attorney office, like that community. Absolutely hated by the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police just for the nature of his work, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a possibility that he might become the next district attorney in Philadelphia when the previous two were Lynn Abraham and Seth Williams, who all have records of sending people to death row, right? And this is, in my opinion, something that might happen. One of the things that he is doing is he's dragging the field completely to the left on the issues that he's running on. He's going to get rid of cash bond for nonviolent drug offenders, nonviolent offenses, period. So there's going to be no bail, no bonds for them. Like so his goal is to alleviate the overcrowding of our city jails, the Philadelphia city jails. He's doing things like that. He's promising to do things like that as a district attorney when usually a district attorney would not want to do that.
Right, right.
He's dragging the field to the left. And this is happening in a city where maybe like 4 years ago, a progressive victory like this wouldn't be possible. But, now because, the post-Trump era that we're living in, right, with that pendulum swinging to the left, with the resistance movement building up, but also you look at what happened. You have Jim Kenney, which is probably one of the most progressive mayors the city's had in a long time. Probably the most progressive mayor ever within the city. And yes, he is a typical politician. Let's put that out there. He's an establishment politician, but he captured that progressive fervor supporting immigrants because of the way his district has changed over the past 20 years. Right. So he became mayor. And then you have someone like Helen Gim, who won a citywide at-large seat 2 years ago in a primary, and she became a city councilwoman.
Right.
So now, my opinion, this door is open for a legitimate shot at someone like Larry Krasner, candidate probably in city history, get elected to an office. I mean, this person is supported by the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. Like, he's supported by all these civil rights movements coming out, all these African-American movements, even though there's other African-Americans within the race, within the primary. And, there's a really great opportunity here for progressives in Philadelphia to elect a true activist to becoming a prosecutor, the city's top prosecutor. So that would be very interesting to see how that office would change if he were to win.
Well, and I think you made a really good point is that, the possibilities of that actually increase as so much energy has been placed on kind of local organizing. And not just, everybody paying attention to what's happened nationally, but actually people getting involved and kind of, learning how to get out the vote, learning how to run candidates, kind of mobilizing at the local level. Because the historic problem has always been for, progressives is progressives just freaking don't show up to vote in off-year elections. And that's, I think people are gearing up to do something different this time. So you're right. I mean, maybe this guy does have a shot.
Right. And then talking about like off-year elections, did you see any of the stories coming up about that race in Georgia that's happening?
Yeah, that's interesting.
The GOP is now seriously concerned about losing a seat to a 30-year-old Democratic candidate. First time in like 20 or 30 years that seat be held by a Democrat.
Well, and we should say, if you look at how that happened too, right, why we're in this place right now is because the first of all, the Democrats, right, were slow to get on board here, right? The Democratic Party was just kind of like, we don't know what we're doing. Initial people when this first kind of came out, because it was Pruitt. It was Pruitt's seat, right?
Yes.
So when Pruitt was kind of
the health secretary, Tillis,
Pruitt's from Oklahoma, right?
Yeah,
Pruitt's a guy from Oklahoma. I'm sorry, what's his name? we'll come back to it. So, yeah, I don't know why I said to. Yeah. So Tillis, I guess. So he, when his seat was vacated, right, then that basically put up for a special election. And the Democrats were just like, we always lose this.
Tom Price. I'm sorry. It's Tom Price.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know why I said, I don't know why I separate. Is that when he came up from when this was coming up for election, the Democrats were like, you know, we always lose down there and all that. But when people started looking at the numbers, and I should say progressives, not like, you know, people, leadership of the Democratic Party, started looking at this and saying, well, you know what? Yeah, it's true that that Price won this seat. However, Hillary only lost by one percentage point, right, in that same district. So now that changes things a little bit, right? What does that mean? What does that mean? So let's get invested, but they were still slow to do. So Daily Kos, right, was one of the organizations. There were others too as well, but one of the organizations that basically said, we've got to get behind this. We actually have an opportunity to target and take this seat, right, from a progressive end of things. And they raised something like $3 million, right, in support, right, of the challenger, right, of the Democratic challenger in this race, and started kind of moving, and that started getting the ball rolling, right, to the Democratic Party is now finally paying attention to what's happening in Georgia. It's been really, really interesting to watch. And, you know, from all indications are now this time, at the very least, it's going to be a super tight race.
Yeah. You know, it's to the point where I saw this morning that the House GOP campaign committee is dumping $2 million into the race.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, but, you know, here's the interesting thing. Now they're late in the game. You know what I mean? They're coming in late with that money. And again, not to say that that won't tilt it or won't tip it, but that's it's kind of an interesting move, especially with this kind of, like, you know, a completely open seat.
And also shows you, I think, like, you know, this is something Sam Cedar keeps on saying repeatedly. There's like, what, 15 or 20 seats that Hillary Clinton won that Democrats didn't challenge, like districts, congressional districts across the country that you could have taken some of these conservatives out.
That's right.
You know, like,
that's what I'm telling you. The Democrats should be wearing this like a big freaking shame, you know, weight around their necks right now, and be flogged for it publicly for not doing that. But, you know, whatever. It's that's retrospect. So I want to go to kind of an actual victory here. That, you know, here we have some potential really cool stuff happening in politics, and then there's a major organizing victory up at Ithaca College. Ithaca College back in May 2015. Had basically voted to become, you know, voted to be a union, right? And they voted with it's SEIU 200 United, and they have been in a protracted battle to get their first contract. And one of the things that's been remarkable about this this win up in Ithaca College in New York has been that they have built alliances with community members, with students, with their unionized faculty members there, because these are the contingent faculty or the adjuncts. They have built alliances into the community. This is the kind of community-based organizing that we've seen, you know, in our own backyard down in Philadelphia, right, with the Caucus of Working Educators, down the FT in Philadelphia. And so it's been really fascinating to watch this development, just in terms of, you know, the rallies and the support they're getting from the community and so on. But really, it was all coming down to what was going to happen. And at the very beginning of this semester, they they basically had a strike authorization. They said that they were going to strike. They moved pretty kind of deliberately and directly in that direction. And this past weekend was basically their deadline, and they were going to say by Tuesday, if they had not had a contract, they were going to walk. And again, the administration looked like they were just going to dig in for it, but late Sunday night, before the way they came to it, actually an agreement, and they won a huge victory. And I just want to touch on a couple things, because this becomes really important for all the higher education organizing that's been going on, especially around kind of adjunct contingent labor, right? These adjuncts are going to get immediate raises, right, as well as annual raises totaling $1,025 per 3-credit course over the life of their contract, right? So that's huge. So most classes are 3 credits. So you're talking about a $3,000 pay increase, right? And that's just for one per class, right, which is huge. The average salary for an adjunct faculty per class right now is about $3,000. So they're going to get $3,000, right? They're basically going to double the average in this contract over the life of this contract. That's huge. They also gain more stability when it came to full-time contingent faculty. After they will be eligible for 2-year appointments after 3 years of teaching, and then after 3 years, and then 3-year appointments after 5 years of teaching in Ithaca College. Again, it's not a tenure track line, but it builds some stability within to that. That's good for the faculty members, and it's good for the students, right? Because then you actually have a more stable faculty, so that students will have access to these faculty members for more than semester to semester. There's also more stability built in for part-time faculty members. Part-time faculty, they're going to be eligible for 2-year appointments after 3 years of teaching at Ithaca College. So bringing people out from the kind of contingent marginality, out away from the most precarious kind of teaching, and then begin to find ways and pathways into a more stable kind of employment. Again, not perfect, not there. But the other thing is they also provided, and I've never seen this in another contract, I'm sure there's other examples out there, but this was really stood out for me. They have a $1,300 kill fee per class. So for example, what that means is that sometimes what happens, you get adjuncts get hired for classes in the fall, and then the classes get canceled, right? Because there's not enough enrollment, whatever that meant. And usually what that means for that faculty member is that you're just, you know, up shit's creek. Is that, you know, tough luck for you. But in this case, they're saying the university has to be a little bit more careful. They have to make better decisions, right? They can't just leave people hanging out to dry, right? That they can plug the waters if they need them. Now they have to say, okay, look, if, you know, if this class doesn't run and we have to tell you that, sorry, we're going to cancel, at the very least, you're going to get $1,300, right? For each class that you have that was canceled. That's really, really a big deal. Why this is kind of, why I want to highlight this is that if we look back in 2015, when SEIU first launched their Faculty Forward campaign nationwide, they've been going like, you know, man, it's like going like crazy, organizing contingent faculty members across the country. And they set this kind of aspirational goal, right? That's what some people were calling it, of $15,000 per class. Right. And even when they proposed it at the time, people were like, that's crazy. Oh, my God, that's even crazy. Even some people who have been longtime advocates of adjunct organizing saying there's no way, there's no way. But what they did right, they looked at that aspirational goal. They set the $15,000 mark. Right. And they learned the thing that, you know, what labor used to know a long time ago. Right. What the Democratic Party and progressives used to know a long time ago is that when you go into negotiations, you don't start your negotiations from what you will take. You start your negotiations from what would be the best for you, right? And so what they've done by like holding that $15,000 out there, basically what it's allowed is allowed people to organize around real substantial increases in pay, right? Real substantial increases in stability, and made people think that we can reimagine the way that this kind of ongoing exploitation of higher education labor has been going on. So, you know, kudos to them. And Tom Schneller, and this is the last I'll close with this, is Tom Schneller, he was on the bargaining committee of SEIU Local 200 United. And he put it like this. He said, quote, "It really was a collective victory. This would never have happened without the massive pressure from our SEI Local 200 United members, from our students, from our tenured and tenured track faculty, and from our Ithaca allies, especially Pete Myers from the Tompkins County's Workers Center, as well as the Cornell Graduate Students United. It was beautiful to witness this coming together of our community and support, and we are deeply grateful to everyone who made this possible. As we have learned from this process, anything is possible when we stop being afraid, reach out to others in sympathy and solidarity, and are tenacious in the pursuit of justice." Right. I mean, for me, that statement is like a summary of what we're seeing happening all over the country right now. So kudos to those folks up in Ithaca College. You know, congratulations, and we'll kind of stand there with you, man. Pretty amazing, Sean.
That sounds great.
Yeah. And so meanwhile, you know, we've got that as a point of victory. And I'll just kind of say this kind of briefly is that meanwhile that this is something that we're going to start watching now is that PASHE, that's the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, has basically started the retrenchment ball rolling. Faculty members at Mansfield University have already been told that the university is planning on retrenching. And again, for the uninitiated, retrenchment is just a fancy word for saying layoffs and program eliminations. This is something that happened after the last contract, and it looks like they're going to do it again. In my own backyard at Kutztown University, and this is not, we're hearing this is happening at other campuses too as well. Most of our temporary faculty members or adjunct faculty members, vast majority, like over 90%, are full time at our university, and they're full time paid on scale with first year tenure track faculty members. They get health benefits and everything like this. So what this new president and this new administration at Kutztown University are going to do is that they're going to turn a bunch of those full time lines into part-time positions. Right. And it looks like that is going to be their pattern now. In one department, all the full-time positions got broken up into part-time positions. In my own department in English, we went from, I think, 7 temporary faculty lines. Now we're getting 3 full-time ones and 3 part-time ones. Right. So not only are you cutting the overall number of faculty members, you're also making them more precarious, right? By disqualifying them from full benefits. And reducing their pay and turning this into this. So it's a bad move that's going forward. And then the other thing that they just did, and this shows you the limitations of basically planning education through the lens of balance sheets and austerity. And this is personal to me because I helped build this class and have taught in this class. One of the classes that we had in the English department was there for, it's called English 022, Introduction to College Composition. We already have a college composition class, what all students are required to either take or place out of or take an honors class as part of Gen Ed. This was an additional class, basically there as an elective course, counted toward graduation and all that credit for credit class, that for students who may basically not have had all the practice that they need in their high schools, right? We come, you know, working at a university that has a lot of first generation college students, a lot of working class students, that, you know, these students come in from school districts all over the map, from some of the best school districts, some of the worst school districts. And this class is basically saying, hey, listen, we're going to give you some guidance about here's what the classes we have, what is best going to suit your needs. And those students choose that class. So roughly about 10% of our incoming first year class, 10% of those students have always elected an English 022. Our university has tried to eliminate that ever since because they see it as remedial, even though this is not a remedial class, right? They see this as remedial, or they see this basically as low-hanging fruit. So on the one hand, you have an administration that basically comes out and says, we're going to make all our decisions based on what's best for the students. And then when the next shoe drops, you find out what's at the bottom of that shoe, right? Are those very students at the bottom of the ladder? So they're eliminating that class, and they decided it's eliminating, I don't know, what, several sections of that class for the fall. And with no reason, no explicit reason, so we suspect that it's nothing but sheer budget cutting. And the students that are going to be impacted the worst are going to be the very students that need it most. So this is kind of the state of public education in this Commonwealth and in the country, certainly in the higher ed level. We hear rumors at this point right now. I want to be clear that these are rumors. I don't know official information or anything like this. We've heard that there's talk of about additional cuts at anywhere between around 5 other campuses and universities. Whether that's accurate or not, we're going to know fairly soon. We're going to be bringing that to you because, you know, we just fought a historic battle, right? A historic strike last year. First time APSCoF has ever gone on strike, the faculty union. And we held the line to protect quality higher education. And now it looks like that they're going to come after it through other means. So stay tuned, folks, because, this is what's coming down the pike. So that's what's kept me basically occupied this week, Sean. That's why I haven't seen the freaking insanity that has gone on in the detail that I've been before. It's just been nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just had something come across my screen. It looks like got some right to work issues coming up in Pennsylvania in the next few weeks.
Oh, grand. Yep. So there we have it, folks. So now you know what we're going to be talking about next week. Right off the top, we're going to have to deal with the right to work stuff. Sean, you got anything there in particular? What does it look like in terms of timeline?
I know that they're set to reintroduce 7 bills aimed at a right to work package of the 7 bills. Metcalf had a press conference on this last week, but it looks like it's getting more play in the media now.
And so that probably means it's getting close to being introduced.
Yeah. So,
well, there we have it. We'll be filing that for next week. So anyways, folks, we're going to take a little break. We'll come back and hopefully we'll have some kind of lighter stuff for you in the kind of last segment of the day. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site.
As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to the Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder. I'm here with Sean Kitchen once again, closing out the day. So, Sean, give me some good news, man.
Urban Barrel Sunnyside's coming out this week, Tuesday, 8 a.m. Doors will open up at Pizza Boy Brewing Company or Isles of Hampton out here in central Pennsylvania. And the beer is expected to fly out of here. $7.50 a can, $45 a six pack.
Oh, good old Sunnyside Bourbon Barrel. That's going to be awesome. So so you're actually going to get your hands on some of these things since you weren't able to be there for the canning?
Yeah, I'm actually going to I actually offered to open up at 8 o'clock on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Just to, so I can get my share. But no, also just like it'll just be quick, easy money. Be there for a couple hours, watch all the beer fly out and go home.
I imagine it's kind of fun too. I mean, you know, it kind of, you know, Pizza Boy's been pretty good about, you know, kind of a little bit of the buildup and people, you know, they love the beer, man, and they get excited about it. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a cool event, a kind of a cause for a little bit of celebration and fun, I guess.
Yeah, the Bourbon Barrel Sunnyside is definitely the best beer we produce on the one out of like the overall, let's say, out of all like the seasonal releases, this is definitely the best one.
It is great. I mean, it really, really, really is awesome. So, yeah, I've got no beer news this week. Although, you know, I did make it way. I stopped by yesterday at, or 2 days ago, I guess, at Saucony Creek, and they had some bombers and stuff they had there. I had this really interesting one. It was called, I'm going to forget the name of it now. It was called Biscotti, something Biscotti. I'll pull it up in a second, but it was really kind of a cool beer. It was kind of it was a Bock beer, I believe, but then it was kind of fermented and like I said, a bed of cranberries or something like this. It had a really kind of cool, interesting taste to it. And I've got some bourbon barrel stouts that are sitting up there too as well that I'll break open at some point this weekend. My original plan was like last night. I really needed it last night. I was like, I was at my wit's end. I said, you know what? That's going to be the nice end of the day, but I fell asleep before I could do it. So that was it. But I decided something, Sean, and that is that I have to find something that's going to help me feel good and on a daily basis. So what I'm going to do, weekly, when the need be, I'm just going to follow what's happening in space. Okay. This is going to be my last segment. My contribution is going to be, what are the cool things that are happening in space? Right. And I can't promise this because I know myself well enough that I this can't be a promise, but I'm going to try not to kind of get into all the possible funding issues and all the kind of stuff the problems with the space. I'm going to try to focus on just the kind of like sheer aspirational parts of that. Okay. So take it for what you will.
Like we're going to Mars.
We're going to freaking Mars, man. And I'm excited about that. Right. I am excited about that.
Would you sign up for the journey to Mars?
Would I sign up for it? Not with kids. No. And once I had, you know, I did something that I, you know, probably in my younger days, I probably would have actually thought about that. I don't know if I have the constitution for it, right?
Honey, I'm going to wait for a few years.
No, that's permanent, right? You go, you're done. I mean, it's like anybody who thinks about their coming back, then you can't have that in your head. But I should say this then too as well. So I started this when I went to Portland. I was just listening to audiobooks and things like this. I was listening to Ian Millhiser's Injustices, which, by the way, everybody should read that freaking book. I heard him interviewed for the first time on the Rick Smith show. This is not what I was going to talk about, but I heard him interviewed for the first time on the Rick Smith show, and he was talking about that book, and it really blew my mind because he was telling a different story about the Supreme Court and the history of the Supreme Court that I was not familiar with, right? Like a lot of people that came up, you know, I was born in 69, right? So like a lot of people that kind of came up with me, we learned about the Supreme Court kind of in the wake of all these civil rights decisions that have been made. And so the Supreme Court had long been this kind of thing that was, you know, a bastion of protection of the kind of the democratic hopes and of rights and people and things like this. Well, Millhiser's book charts a longer history of that. And so that was actually an aberration in terms of the history of the court and the kind of things that we see happening now, all this liberty to contract crap, all this kind of like, you know, rights of employers and all that kind of stuff. That was the predecessor where we are now. People talk about
Lochner
era. Yep. It mm-hmm. was Lochner, but a whole bunch of stuff that was going on before then. So read that book. So anyways, so I'm sitting on the plane, I'm listening to that. And then I just get kind of like, I just need to do something else. And I was on one of these new Boeing planes, 747 or whatever it was. And they've got the TV, like right in the back of the seat in front of you. And you can choose a whole bunch of stuff. And I saw this National Geographic had has a series out called Mars. Right. And so I said, oh, this is cool. I like science fiction, you know, it's kind of get lost in this for a while, but it's actually a really good series. And so it's kind of part fictional, part historical. And basically what it does, the story is basically set in like 2034, where the first mission to Mars is going. Right. And it's all based on kind of scientific stuff that is in the works right now. But what's cool is they keep on going back and forth in time between like 2034 and 16, when the series was kind of put together. And what happens in 2016 is you're actually getting interviews with scientists and people that are involved in the Mars exploration today, like real people, real interviews about kind of that looking forward. So you kind of go this back and forth. So it's this interesting move on the part of National Geographic as a way of kind of talking about some of the science and what's being planned and looking forward. But then also putting it into this this narrative, this story, this fictional account of the first kind of, you know, launch to Mars. It's actually a good series. I mean, I was actually, I've been watching it now. So that's kind of cool. But so that was kind of, you know, part of the kind of geeky stuff on it. So, you know, check out that series. It's kind of interesting if you're interested in space stuff. But the history was made this week, though. I've got to say, with SpaceX. SpaceX, you know, the Elon Musk or kind of like, you know, all over kind of thing. They do Tesla and then they got SpaceX and that's all Elon Musk. But for the first time, first of all, one of the biggest costs about space exploration has to do with the rockets, right? Your stage one boosters, that's where your engines are. That's where all the fuel is and all that kind of stuff. And those things are super expensive. So what SpaceX has been after is basically try to land that part of the rocket. So blast it off. Right. And then instead of it just burning up in the atmosphere or just junking it to try to land it back on the planet. And that's important for two reasons. One, because if you land it and you can reuse that, right, your costs go way, way, way down. Right. So that's the first part of it. And the second part of it is you're also building up kind of the practical science of like, how do you land a rocket? Right. Especially if you're going to send something to Mars, how do you ensure you can land something like this on another planet? So it's really kind of just a fascinating back and forth. And so now they've successfully landed, I think, six, maybe nine of the rockets now. Right. They've done like several in a row. But yesterday was the first time that they actually launched, used a rocket that had already been out into space. This is the first time a rocket that as a reusable rocket has been used to launch something up. And we used to launch some sort of communication satellite or something like this. But it's kind of a historical marker, right? It's a historical marker for this new round of space exploration. And through something that really don't know where it's going to go. And, you know, there's lots of kind of interesting possibilities here. Some of ones that are rather dark, right? Because we're using privatized space exploration now. And there's been talk now even about potentially selling off the space station after it's supposed to go out of commission in 2024, but that might be extended to 2028. And then they're actually saying, you know, should a corporation take it over, which is a very disturbing possibility in my mind, right? Especially when it comes to science. But anyway, so that's my week in space. So that's what I'll be doing is I'll be following that, right, for my feel good parts of the week that are going to get me through the assault on everything that is our democracy and our planet. So
what you're telling me is you're not going to be following a damn thing over the next couple of weeks.
No, I am. Like this is seriously, this is what I do when I'm like, I need to get to sleep and I got to do something that's just going to distract me. so that my mind doesn't go crazy. That's really, I'm not even joking. It's just, it's a kind of interesting track to follow, right? There's interesting things that are going on. And it just kind of coincided what I started doing. Like I said, I was reading that book, The Sixth Extinction, which is some of the science in there is just fascinating, right? It's just a really well-told stuff about the science. And so it's kind of a way of geeking out a little bit and thinking about possibility instead of just, you know, destruction, if that makes sense. Oh, man. Anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
No, that's everything.
That's everything. Yeah, that's what we got. All right, everybody. That's it. I'm out of here. I'm going to go out now.
No, I'm just like
talking on the podcast now.
it's like Cliff Schechter's on right now.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah, I'm sorry.
We're running into my Majority Report time, man.
No, I'm sorry. I'm really doing you wrong. All right. So, and you can always see this at the end of our podcast right here. You see Sean, because like when I'm talking about whatever the hell is I'm talking about, suddenly you can see Sean's eyes lit up by the computer, and he's like following news that has nothing to do with this anymore because he's done with the podcast for the day.
You're talking about Mars, and I'm just like, see what's going on in politics, like some of the local things. Like,
shut up with your freaking Mars thing. I'm just gonna. All right,
space,
man.
Well, man. Hey, who cares about space?
Yeah, I do, I guess. So it's been quite a week, folks. Stay tuned for us next week, and we'll definitely get on the right to work stuff, and we'll kind of update you on where that is and all the other insanity, and hopefully some fun. That is the world we are in today. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will talk to you next week. See ya!